how are you all tonight after Native New Yorker? My poppy was born in Pensacola in 1886, and I grew up with him until I was 13 when he passed away. So y'all isn't foreign to me. Anyway, I'm Robert, and I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. My anniversary date is November 16th, 1979. This is my 40th year of continuous sobriety, for which I am enormously grateful. So, my home group is the As You Like It home group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Charlotte till 10 o'clock Sunday morning, the Martha Jefferson on Pantops. Lynn Hill comes all the time. I say that because you say your last name. Right. All right. So, I grew up in New York. I was born in Brooklyn, and I grew up on Long Island. And I came from a large Catholic, Italian-Irish Catholic family. I have five sisters, and I also say we have a neighbor sister, so I had six sisters, and growing up, and my grandfather, my great aunt, in a three-bedroom, one-bathroom house. Yeah. So someone's had to make an appointment to get in there. So I mentioned my granddad, my grandfather, John Henry Seeley, because he was my first introduction into alcohol, actually. He was an alcoholic who became senile and forgot to drink. He stopped drinking. Yeah, he completely forgot to drink. So the thing is, in the early days, he would, I'm talking like when I was like 4 or 5 years old, he'd take me to the bars with him in Valley Stream, where I grew up, and he'd sit me up on the bar stool, and he'd drink, and I'd get a Coca-Cola. And even at that early age, I knew there was something different about that Coca-Cola than the Coca-Cola we had at home, because the ice cubes are different. The ice cubes commercially are clear, the ones at home are not clear. And I knew that. I suspected that. Of course, I didn't know that at the moment. And, alcohol was presented as kind of a joyous thing. Because on the way home, he had a few, and he'd buy me things. So alcohol bought me things, okay? And my great aunt, who was his sister-in-law, we all also lived together, and she was born in Pensacola in 1876. And so she was a steel magnolia, Rosanna Hughes Steely. She was a steel magnolia. And she would, I'd make hot toddies for her to bring up to her bedroom, and she'd take them with a sleeping pill, which, of course, when I got out into the world, I found out those were Tylenols. And she'd take her hot toddy with a sleeping pill, and I'd taste those hot toddies, and go, oh, this tastes awful, awful, but I always tasted them every time, that was the drinking in my house. And my grandfather, remember, he was divorced from my grandmother. I remember one time we all went to my grandmother's in Trenton, New Jersey. And when we came back, my grandfather was passed out on the dining room floor with a bottle of, I'm sure it was some kind of Gordon's, because I remember the label was red and white and had yellow in it. I mean, these are the things, who remembers that stuff but an alcoholic, I mean, I wasn't drinking yet, but that's what I remembered. He was passed out on the floor. So, and also, like, I remember one time I came home from a Boy Scout, a Cub Scout, and it was really cold. And I was like shivering like this, and my parents gave me brandy to warm me up. I had trouble with my gums or my teeth. They put that on my gums or my teeth, right? So alcohol was presented as something good. I never saw anything really horrible, except my grandfather that one time when we came home, he was passed out on the floor. Otherwise, I didn't really notice anything. And there was always beer around. I mean, my parents had a lot of parties, Brooklyn parties, cold cuts and beer. And at my first Holy Communion, we have a 8-millimeter. And all my aunts and uncles are all in the yard with beer cans in their hands, And this was just something that was always present, it was a beer can. So my mother, I believe, became an alcoholic, or she was already. She used to tell us a story that my father was in, she was a war bride. They were married on March 10th, 1945. So today would have been their 74th wedding anniversary. And they died 3 years ago on either side of their 71st wedding anniversary. And so she used to tell a story. He was in Fort Pendleton, so after they got married, they took a train out there. And they went to Tijuana. And she said, I don't remember getting home. I don't remember anything about getting home. So that was her first blackout that she recorded or remembered. And many years later, when I was drinking and had a house for the summer over on Fire Island, my mother came over, and we all drank pretty heavily that day. And when I spoke to her later that day or the next day, she said, I don't remember getting home. That sea air must have just, she said, I don't know what happened. It must have been the sea air. She was, again, in a blackout. So anyway, I never really saw her drunk until I was, now I'm not saying she wasn't, like when she went to parties. I didn't see them when they came home. So, but when I started drinking, that's when I would see her drunk, because we would drink together, you know. And she'd say to me, Robert, make my drinks. Your father makes them too weak, you know. And, of course, I was a good son, so I made them really good. I had my first drunk. Now, I mean, we had beers. I was thinking about this today. We had beers in the refrigerator, but I never went and got one. But somehow this summer night, I was with some buddies. I was 15 years old. I guess nobody asked for ID in those days. And I knew I wanted to get drunk, even though I didn't really know what drunk was, you know. And we went to the deli, and I bought not one beer. I bought two beers, and not regular-sized beers. I bought tall boys. And we went over to the campus of the high school, and I drank those beers, and I thought, this is the best thing that has ever happened to me, ever. And, of course, in sobriety, I learned what happened that night was all my fears went away. I had no more fears. That alcohol just took those fears right out of me, and I didn't care, and I couldn't wait to do it again. So through my teenage years, I drank, and then I went to art school in Manhattan, and I experienced other things there. And the first time I experienced those things, I didn't know what high was, so I kept taking those things. And I was up for 3 days. And I said, I don't know what's going on here. I don't know what's the matter with this. I don't feel high. And I was just like this. You can imagine what that was that I took, you know. So I drank, you know, then I moved into Manhattan. I was traveling back and forth from school out to Stony Brook, which we lived at that time, which was like it was 2.5 hours on the train. So I got an apartment in Queens, and it was 1968, and it was New York City, and it was absolutely incredible. You know, clubs, the life, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, you know, it was just all there. And I lived it, and I'm glad I did, and I'm glad it was over. So when people ask me about why I don't drink now, I said my drinking privileges were revoked in 1979. I said it was taken away from me. The last club that I was ever at was Studio 54. And anything you've heard about it or seen any documentary on it or any movie about it, it's absolutely true. Everything that is said is that's what it was. And that was the last time I was to a club, and that was the summer of 1979. And then I got sober in November of that year. So I'm just going to go into my bottom, because I think the bottom is really important. Today, at the morning, this morning, Lynn, somebody, and I had said this, we have no right to steal anybody's bottom. We have no right to take anybody's bottom away from them. Everybody has to have their bottom. Because without a bottom, we don't get it. Some people have to repeat over and over and over, and that's not their bottom. Fortunately, with God's grace, I say this all the time, with God's grace and my willingness, which is the key to my sobriety, is my willingness. God's grace is afforded to every person and every alcoholic. But what do we do with that grace? That's the question there. So it's God's grace that I'm sober, but it's my willingness, because I had to get in my car and I had to say yes to Sam that I would do this tonight. My willingness to get in my car and drive 40 minutes, whatever it was, 45 minutes to come and speak tonight. So I'm basically here for myself. I'm not really here for you, although I am, because my primary purpose is to stay sober and to help alcoholics achieve sobriety. That is my primary purpose in life. In fact, I was talking about this morning at the meeting. I said, that's my work. Everything else is higher power's work. Everything else is higher power's work. I do this, higher power, you have to do that for me. And higher power does that. Of course, higher power didn't go out and buy my home, didn't buy my car, but through God's grace and my willingness, I've been in a position where I could do those things. And that's what I need in order for me to do this work. If I didn't have a car, I couldn't be here tonight. If I didn't have a car that's working in good condition, I couldn't be here tonight. If I didn't have a car that was fast, I wouldn't be here tonight. So my bottom. I had gotten into this sort of alcoholic, place, snit, and I wasn't talking to my parents. I didn't talk to them for a year. This was in the whole year of 1978. And we had a cousin who was having a wedding, big Irish wedding, like 250 people. And my parents were living in Arizona at that point. They had moved there, and they came back, and they were at my sister's house on Long Island. I came from Manhattan and stayed with my sister. Here I am seeing my parents for the first time in a year. Excuse me. Nobody said anything. I went out there armed with a bag of weed, and we started drinking. Next day, we had the wedding, Saturday. I was really toasted. And we went back to my aunt's house, and I had two aunts that lived on the same street in very similar houses, and I don't know which house I was in. I kept thinking, where am I? Is this which house is this? It was like looking into like a mirror, like double mirrors, trying to figure out where I was. It didn't matter. I didn't care. I remember it was packed with all of these Irish people drinking. And so it was time to leave, and we get in the car. I'm in the front seat with a beer, because I had to have a beer. I couldn't drive home without a beer, you know. My father was driving. I wasn't driving. So my mother says, Robert, can I have a sip of your beer? I said, sure, Ma. And I just threw the can into the back seat. You know, it's like, yeah, Ma, here you go. I wouldn't be malicious. That's what it was. So that night, I don't know what happened after that. Next thing I know, I'm waking up in the morning in the corner of the dining room, suit on, buttoned up, passed out in the corner of the dining room. My family sitting around the table having breakfast. So, you know, alcoholism is a family disease. So my father, I get up, and I'm like, okay. I take my jacket off and put it in the back of the chair. I sit down. My father says, how do you want your eggs? Not, what are you doing passed out in the corner of the dining room? So I said, whatever I said, you know. And he said, what went on here last night? I'm like, I have no idea. So your mother's clothes started at the front door and went all the way up the steps. And I was like, I don't know what she was doing, but it didn't involve me. So shortly after that moment, my mother said, I said to my mother, my mom, you want a Bloody Mary? Well, of course, the answer was yes, you know. So we started drinking Bloody Marys, and I guess we were drinking all day. I don't really remember that day very much. And this was a Sunday, I guess, yeah. And so we went out for a family dinner that night, and that's really when the bottom started. My older sister has an eating disorder. And my mother was a fatophile. She did not like fat. And my sister was overweight. And my brother-in-law asked my sister how her steak was. Well, first of all, I ordered a martini. My mother ordered a martini. And I took my sip, and I was looking at her, and I just saw her shades go down like this. And I, at the same time, I could feel mine go down, right? I could just feel, I was gone. And so when my brother-in-law asked my sister that question, my mother said, how would she know she's halfway through it? My mother was just something. She was a wonderful person, but you know, this stuff gets in the way. You know, she was a loving person, but she and my sister were adversaries for whatever reason their whole life. So my sister got up from the table crying, and I turned to my mother and I used some profanity, which, you know, in my house, we didn't use profanity. I mean, the worst thing my mother ever said was damn it to hell, and that was when she was furious. So I used this profanity, and you know, you think you'd get this family up and get them out of there, right? No, we stayed, and we had more dinner, and we had more drinks. And so we're leaving the restaurant. I mean, the waitress came over and said, what's that young woman doing downstairs crying? She's down in the bathroom crying. What's going on here? The waitress got involved, you know. So, yeah. So we got into the car, and my mother couldn't negotiate getting in the back seat. And I thought it was very funny. She thought it was very funny. The valet thought it was very funny. My father didn't think it was so funny, you know. So we got in the car, and they have to understand, my father adored my mother. Whatever she wanted to do, we did. She didn't want to go home. She wanted to go to my father's boss's house. So we went to my father's boss's house, which were also good friends of ours also. And fortunately, we left there without incident, except we left with a 12-pack of beer because we didn't have any left at home, so we drank the case. And Sunday night, you couldn't buy any beer. So so I go upstairs to go to pass out, I guess. I was called it sleep in those days, but it was pass out. And I open the window a little bit, and I hear this whimpering, this crying, this whimpering. My youngest sister was with us, and she's kind of an emotional wreck. But my parents were fighting, and I got up, which probably was, I mean, it was a mistake actually to get up, but it led to my bottom, so it was good. So the next thing I know, I mean, my father and I are brawling, you know, we're wrestling, throwing punches, and I'm standing over my mother using profanity, calling her GDMF, my mother, to my mother. And the next day, I'm getting out of here, and I call a cab. I don't know whether the cab came or not, because I woke up in the hallway on the floor. I didn't sleep in a bed the whole weekend. On the floor. I don't know. Like I said, I was going back to Manhattan. That's where I lived at the time. And my sister, my older sister, whose home it was, my mother was, like, not talking to anybody. She was, like, nothing. And my older sister kept saying to me, Mommy has a problem. I'm like, what? She said, Mommy has a problem. I'm like, Mommy has a problem? Oh, my God, Mommy's an alcoholic. Within seconds, ding, 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 and you matched her drink for drink. Wow. So I went back into Manhattan, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous to find out about meetings in Prescott, Arizona for my mother. there's plenty of meetings there. And that's the truth. I mean, when you go to a meeting in Prescott, at the end of the meeting is when they sign the papers, you know, there's a stack like this. It's full of recovery houses, recovery, what do you call them? Treatment centers. Yeah, treatment centers. A stack like that. So I thought the woman was going to hang up. She said, well, you know, we don't do third-party intervention or calls, you know. And I said, well, what if I thought I might be an alcoholic? She said, well, why don't you come down to intergroup office and talk to somebody? So that night I called a friend up and went down to a very nice little restaurant I used to go to. I was working in the industry. And my friend Susan, and we, you know, before dinner cocktails for me at that point were, you know, a little smoke and a couple beers. That was before dinner cocktails, before we got to the restaurant. Then at the restaurant, it was Scotch with Heineken Chasers, two of those, before dinner. That was before dinner cocktails. And so we ordered all this food, beautiful French food. And Susan's, oh, I'm so tired. She kind of passed out in the appetizer. So I picked her up, and I put her in a cab. I didn't take her home. I put her in a cab and sent her home. And I had gone to this restaurant a lot, so I knew a lot of the people that worked there. So there was an off-duty bartender. I guess he'd come in to get a paycheck or something. I said, I have all this food. Come, you want to sit down? So he sat down, and we ate, and we drank again. And I woke up, or came to, in a bar down in the West Village on a bench. And a bartender and a suit tie, you know, because if I was suit and tie, I could be an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. How could you be an alcoholic if you wore a suit and tie? You know? And I got home that night. That next morning I got up and I was a mess. I was shaking. But I got in a suit and tie and I went down to Intergroup. It was in the Flatiron Building on the third floor. And so I talked to somebody there and they said, well, we suggest 90 meetings in 90 days. I went, oh, okay, and gave me a meeting list. And I left, and I walked down the steps, which took about, you know, 20 minutes from the time he said 90 minutes to 90 days. I got down on the street, and I was like, wait, that's a meeting a day. It took me 20 minutes to figure that out. That's how fried my brain was. And my immediate reaction was what? Oh, that's way too much. I'm much too busy for that, you know. So anyway, this is the miracle right here that I'm going to tell you about. I was a waiter, and I went into work that night, and one of the people I worked with, a young woman named Diana S., we drink after shift, and I said to her, Diana, she's a little thin, but like, she's about probably like about 5'4", and, you know, I'm like 6 foot, and I said, Diana, I'm going to start going to AA meetings. And so this is the miracle. She put her hands on my shoulders, and she looked up at me, and she said, Robert, I've been going to meetings for 3 days. So she told me about this meeting, Fireside, in the YMCA on 63rd Street. And it meant on those days, when I started, after a while it was meeting every day, but in those days it was meeting Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. But I couldn't go Wednesday because I had a date that night. Not in the afternoon. It was a noon meeting. And I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know anyway. So that night I had one glass of wine. And somehow I knew, I don't know how I knew this, but somehow I knew that was it. That was the last glass I was up in. I didn't want any more. So that Friday, she said, well, let's meet at the 64th Street entrance. So I met her there. Well, I didn't meet her because she didn't show up. So it was like 5 minutes. The meeting started at 12:30, I think. It was 25 after, and I thought, well, are you going to go in? And you know what? I'm sort of grateful that she didn't show up because I went in on my own, so to speak. I walked in on my own. She came. She was just late, you know. And I was, like, blown away. It was a noon meeting. It was a lot of business people, and people were in suits and ties, so alcoholics did wear suits and ties. And I had a suit and tie on. And I was thrilled because I thought it was going to be just these filled with like old men in dirty London fog raincoats, sort of humped over with the collar up, smoking cigarettes like this, you know. And I mean, people were smoking in those days in the rooms. But it was this bright, cheery, convivial, almost, you know, that deafening sound that AAs make when they're all together. But it's sort of a joyous sound, you know. And I thought, wow, this is really something. There was a speaker. I did what I came to learn was identify with him. And I left that meeting, and, well, first I thought it was really good. And then we stood up and said, the Our Father. I was like, oh, boy, what is that? But I came back because I had to come back. I had searched out Dianetics. I had searched out Est. I went to therapy that failed, you know, so I was looking for something, and this was it. But that day, it was a beautiful November day, November 16th, still some color on the trees, bright blue, crisp sky. I walked through Central Park for 14 blocks and cried the entire way home, the entire way. And I went back to another meeting. I don't remember my second meeting. I remember my first meeting, but not my second meeting. In fact, I don't remember any meeting between this one and this morning and the first one. You know, I mean, this time has gone by. It's just absolutely unbelievable. So I had trouble getting a sponsor because I couldn't tell the difference between asking somebody to marry me and asking somebody to be my sponsor. There wasn't much difference there. You know, it was like the rejection was like, oh, my God, but if they don't, they reject me. So I started working the steps. The first step we admitted we were alcoholics and our lives had become unmanageable. The first part I got, the unmanageable part I couldn't get at first, because I thought, well, you know, I mean, I have an apartment, I have a job, you know, this and that. And the reality was, is that in that case, it wasn't my outer life that was so unmanageable. It was my emotional life that was completely unmanageable. Little did I know that the steps were going to deal with the emotional life, not with alcohol, right? You know, I love that saying, you can take the alcohol out of the alcoholic, but you still have the ick. And the ick is what we have to deal with, right? So eventually I came to understand that, you know, that was a two-part circumstance there. So I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I thought, well, yeah, looking back, some of the stuff I do is pretty insane, you know, so I could get that. Third step was I would get tremors thinking about something having control over me, made a decision to turn my life and my will over to God as I understand God. I'd be like, I'd realize I'd actually go into physical tremors. So today, when I talk to a newcomer, I say, I understand that you're afraid to do that. I said, but every time we took a drink, we turned our life and will over to alcohol. And that was not a benevolent force that was going to be kind and loving to us. And the light starts to go on. I said, look, you know, it's making a decision. And I have to tell you today, in my life, when I go into some kind of fear, I think I've made a third step. Every day I do a third step. What could I be concerned about? If I've turned my life and my will over to the care of my higher power, which for me is love, which for me is goodness and greatness and benevolence and order, perfect order, perfect mind, what could I be frightened of? So then we went into the fourth step. I couldn't figure out the columns in the book. I know, and I take my sponsees through the columns in the book today, but I couldn't figure it out. So I did this this questionnaire that Hazelton put out. And, you know, basically, you could, in the 12 and 12, you could just write down the questions in the 12 and 12 and answer all those questions, and you got a fourth step, right? Because there's a lot of questions in the fourth step in the 12 and 12. Lots of questions. So, and then I did my fifth. And I mean, I've done a lot of fifth steps, you know, of my character defects. And there's nothing I've done in my life before I stopped drinking or after I stopped drinking that I have any shame about that somebody doesn't know. I don't have any secrets, you know, of things that I'm shameful about. And I think that's the important thing that people have to know. We have to get rid of that stuff. You know, we have to keep our center we have to keep our spiritual center. We have to keep coming back to center, spiritual center, in order to maintain sobriety and to be of usefulness to our brothers and sisters who we look to help, right? Isn't that that's what it's about, you know? It's all of our steps that are bringing us to the spiritual center. And fortunately, through the wisdom of higher power, through Bill and the first 100, they came up with, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. So I did fifth and six and seven. You know, six was like, okay, I'm ready to take those, you know. I mean, that took a long time for those to be. I mean, I still have some of them, you know. In 40 years, I still have some of those character defects. You know, imagine that. And I'm not perfect. I still have stuff to work on, you know. Going back to my concern about like God in AA, what I learned was is that I didn't have a problem with God. I had a problem with religion, basically the religion of my youth. But I had a healing with that religion. Not that I practice it, but I can go there and be comfortable and joyful in the parts that I want to be comfortable and joyful about. In the basic basic tenets of that religion, which I think are beautiful, you know, it's the man-made part that expanded on it. You know, that is not so good. So I can't imagine living my life each day without my higher power. I didn't say the seven-step prayer for a long time. I mean a long time. I'm like, the hard part was all of me, good and bad. That was really, the good part was okay. The bad part was really tough. And I've come to realize that, of course, is humility. When I finally started praying the seven-step prayer, I'm now willing to shed all of me, good and bad, that I may come about to do your work. I had to do that. And it changed my life. It was okay. I said, you're okay even with all of your warts. You're okay with all of your character defects. So the thing to remember, if you're not up to your fourth step, is you can't get rid of them unless you know what they are. We have to know what our character defects are. And they're not defects of character, they're character defects. There's a difference. So what I've learned also is that character defects are survival mechanisms in childhood. Stealing, cheating, lying, making up stories, that's all part of a survival mechanism to survive or move away from fear. And, you know, it's so in a child, it's one thing, but in an adult, it doesn't look too good. You know, it doesn't look too good. In fact, one of the things I first learned in therapy before I got sober was that I was going to learn what caused the situation. So it was information gathering, is what therapy was. It was information gathering. And of course, that's what we do here. We information gather. And then we can learn how to deal with whatever it is we need to deal with, to move away from it, in order that we might be of service to God and to each other. That's what this whole thing is about for me, is about being of service, not just here in Alcoholics Anonymous, but in the world. Interestingly enough, that's what my business is. I'm an event planner, caterer, and I am of service. Last night, I was of service. I was pouring wine. I was serving food. I was talking to people. I was making sure they were comfortable and having a good time. That's service. But it's also service out on the street. You know, it's being able to look at a homeless person and say, hello, how are you today? I don't have to give them money when I say that, although I don't mind giving them money. But it's about being of service. What is it that you need? So many years ago, I was going into the post office downtown, the downtown mall. But coming out of New York, you know, in those days, homeless people would hold the door of the ATM open for you, you know. And so my standard answer was, when they asked for money, was, excuse me, not today, maybe tomorrow. So when this man said to me, hey, mister, can you help me? I said, not today, maybe tomorrow. Now, I couldn't tell this story for a couple of years without bursting into tears, because it was the humility and the love that I was shown by my higher power. So I walk into the post office, and this voice, which I've come to know as the voice of my higher power, and it always starts out with Robert. I was like, okay, you didn't even ask him what he needed. He didn't ask for money. He said, can you help me? So I turned around and went back out, and I asked him what he needed. And he was hungry. So, I mean, I serve fancy food to fancy people. How could I not buy food for somebody? That's an impossibility, you know? So I go get him a sandwich, and then he says, can you drive me home? I'm like, okay, higher power. So I said, sure. So we get in the car, and he said to me, where did you grow up? And I told him where I grew up. I said, where did you grow up? He said, in reform school. He said, I also have cancer, and I'm dying. So I never saw that man again. But the lesson there was the love of my higher power. I was loved so much that my higher power gave me this incredible experience. I swear I could not tell this story without bursting into tears for years. Through humility and through the love, the great love that I have been given. So, you know, I always say, like, in the ninth step is the great spiritual step. That is at 9, because we have a lot of work to do before we get there. We have a lot of spiritual work to do before we get to 9. I mean, I went out and I was like, oh, I'm sorry, a couple of times to different people, you know, but nothing major. Early on, I told my mother I was sorry. She said, oh, you never hurt me. You know, so anyway, whatever that was. she probably didn't remember. She probably didn't remember that night. So 9 is really, it's a really spiritual process. To actually be able to look somebody in the eyes and talk to them about the harm that I had caused, or to write a letter not knowing whether you were forgiven or not. And it's not about that. It's not about getting forgiven. It's about getting rid of the stuff in order to move to what our spiritual center, in order to be of maximum use to each other. You know, when I was out there, you know, when I saw Crazy walking up the street, I didn't cross the street. I walked up and introduced myself. Said, hello, Crazy. I'm Robert. Let's, I don't know, run off together, you know, or do something together. So now, then, or I would cross the street with shame when I saw somebody I had harmed. And now I don't have to do that. Or if I do, I have to make right and do a 10th step and then do a 9th step back, you know, and again, because I can't carry that shame around. Excuse me just a second. So early on, my imagery was that I carried this sack around with me filled with crap, character defects. I didn't know that. And I carried it into bar after bar. You know, I didn't know I was drinking over all the stuff in the bag. All that stuff that I had in this bag that I was dragging around in my life, I was drinking over. So I got sober, and eventually I started taking stuff out of the bag. You know, through recovery, we start to empty the bag of character defects. We start to empty the bag of shame. We start to empty the bag of self-loathing. We start to empty the bag of resentments. And eventually, I just had the bag. So I let go of the bag. But I'd like to say that the bag was let go forever, but occasionally I'd pick up that bag again, you know, and start to drag the bag around again. But I had the spiritual tools of Alcoholics Anonymous to help me work with this and to move on through it, because I need to come back to spiritual center in order to be of maximum use, a maximal use to you and my fellows in the world, you know. Living amends is a great amends. So like with my family, I didn't go to anything. And then I started going to everything. I went to everything I could possibly get to, baptisms, weddings, anniversaries, birthdays, whatever the occasion was, I started going. And that was kind of my living amends to them, was to come back and to be with them. Because they love me. And get this, I love them. You know, I love them. You know, and I love my parents, and we didn't always have the greatest relationship. I mean, it was fine. You know, when my father died, you know, they lived in Arizona. I saw them once a year for 40 years, 35, whatever it was, years. And it wasn't like I was going to miss the fireside chats, because we didn't have fireside chats, my dad and me. You know, but I have the things that I remember that I did with him. Like my sister Janet, she's young, she's two sisters younger than me. She thought I didn't have any relationship with him at all. But we moved out to Long Island, to his brand new, beautiful home, to 4 bathrooms, not one. I thought I'd never leave there, but after a year, I left. We landscaped the whole place together. We'd go to this cousin of my grandmother's who had a nursery, and we'd buy trees and bushes, and we'd go and plant them, and I designed the yard. We did that stuff together, you know. I mean, there were things that, you know, we did together. And I'm eternally grateful that he was my father. I was very proud of him. He was a Marine in World War II. I'm proud for his service. He had a Purple Heart. He fought in the Pacific, and that was some of the worst wars ever, some of the worst battles ever. He was this 18-year-old He graduated in 1942, June, and went into the service that summer. I wore, I had his high school ring on last night. And he and my mother had a commitment. I would have never stayed with my mother. I didn't have that kind of stick-to-itness, you know. But they showed us commitment, and they had some hard times. They had some really difficult times, but they stayed together. So my sobriety. You know, I just had my 70th birthday, and it freaked me the freak out. Okay, I hid. I had my birthday. I was hoping everybody forgot. Nobody forgot. But it took me a month to listen to the messages and my answering before I listened to my birthday messages. The reason I tell you that is because I am so happy to share and celebrate my AA anniversary. Well, of course, it's still young. You know, I mean, it's old in AA, but it's young, number-wise. And so that's why I even mentioned that. You know, I'm thrilled to celebrate this anniversary because this birthday, because it was a rebirth. You know, I and you who are sober have been reborn. We've been reborn into a new world, into a new life. However, I remember at some point I thought, I remember who you are. You're that sweet kid who loved life, who enjoyed everything before the world got to you and started the shame thing, you know, and told you who you had to be and who you weren't. And I remember that in sobriety. I came to that point where I remember and I said, wow, he's still around. So I kind of believe that sobriety has brought me back to the truth of who I really am. And I believe it does it for all of us. It brings us back to the core truth of who we really are. A beloved child of the Most High God. A beloved child of the Most High God. Think about that. It's pretty incredible. I could really kind of, I'm holding back emotion right now. That just blows me away. And that was the same love that that higher power showed me in that post office that day. So I think I'll wrap it up, you know, and we have sharing after that. Is that it? Is that what happens or no? You just, what, the meeting just ends?
No, there's a closer.
Oh, the closer, wow. That's pretty good. Well, thank you, everyone, for being here tonight and supporting me in my sobriety. Yeah.